Gracie Jiu-Jitsu rocks. Welcome to the Gracie Jiu-Jitsu Rocks podcast, a podcast dedicated to Gracie Jiu-Jitsu and all things Gracie, including self-defense, competition, anti-bullying, women's self-defense and empowerment, nutrition, and most especially, the people involved in Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. This podcast is for the average Joe. It's for anyone who practices, trains, teaches, or just loves to talk about or hear about Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. We'll explore the lives of Gracie Jiu-Jitsu practitioners, how they got involved in the art, and what effect it's had on their lives. So buckle up and enjoy the ride. Welcome to episode 44 of the Gracie Jiu-Jitsu Rocks podcast. As always, I'm your host, Marty Josie, and thanks for listening. Got a great show for you today. My guest will be Chris Saunders, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But let's start off with a Jiu-Jitsu quote, and that is, Jiu-Jitsu puts you completely in the moment, where you must have a complete focus on finding a solution to the problem. This trains the mind to build that focus, to increase your awareness and your capacity to solve problems. And this is attributed to Grandmaster Hixon Gracie. Okay, now I'd like to read something from Phil Miglerice. And Phil was my guest on episode 41 of the show. He is a Gracie Black Belt and owns and operates Balance Studios in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And Phil recently turned 40 and recently wrote something called 10 Things I Learned in My 40 Years. So let me share those with you. Number one, be grateful every day. I use morning ritual to be conscious of all the things for which I'm grateful. Two, chase your passion. You only live once, so don't deny your passion. Three, choose your words wisely. They can hurt worse than a sidekick in the gut. 4. Listen first, speak second. 5. Mind your own business. Focus on what you're doing and be happy with other successes. I like the saying, don't count other people's money. Number 6. Breathe and don't be reactive. Before you react with rage, take a breath and refocus your energy. 7. If you're having a bad day and nothing is going right, say the word Snoopy out loud. It's impossible to feel bad after you do it. 8. Don't take your failures or your successes too seriously. They are all temporary. 9. Say what you mean when you feel it. Tell your loved ones you love them. Do not wait until it's too late. And 10. Minimize your maximum regret. Very cool words from Phil Miglerice. Okay, after the interview, stay tuned for the Make a Difference, Make an Impact segment. And also, don't forget to send in any questions you have for Hixon Gracie, who will be joining us again sometime in the near future to answer questions and talk about a few things. Okay, on to our interview. My guest is Chris Saunders, and Chris is a Gracie Jiu-Jitsu black belt, fourth degree black belt, and he was Grandmaster Hixon Gracie's first American black belt. So the first American awarded the black belt from Master Hixon Gracie. He's also part of the group known as the Dirty Dozen, which is the first 12 Americans to be promoted to black belt by a Gracie family member. He's also a certified instructor through the Gracie Jiu-Jitsu Academy in Torrance, California, and teaches at the Gracie Academy in Beverly Hills. He's a very interesting guy, and I'm sure you're going to really enjoy this interview. So without further ado, let's talk to Chris now. So I'm speaking with Chris Saunders. So welcome to the show, Chris, and thanks very much for taking time to speak with us today.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
All right, so you've been around a long time and have a great history in the martial arts or in jiu-jitsu. So let's just start by, where are you from originally, Chris, and how did you get going in martial arts?
Well, I live in California, and I was born here, Torrance, California. So I'm an L.A. native, which is kind of cool. Anyway, I guess I never really did any traditional martial arts. When I was about 21, a friend of mine and myself were at a party in Palos Verdes, and we were leaving the party, and some kind of big guy who I didn't see at the party, I didn't recognize him, kind of walked up to me, and he said, "What'd you say to me?" I said, "I didn't say anything to you." And he's kind of aggressive coming at me, and he starts pushing me. And then I see another guy walking up, and I'm thinking, oh, cool, this guy's going to say, "Hey, buddy, it's cool, chill out." But it turns out this other guy is his friend. And my friend kind of took off. So I'm by myself, and these two guys are basically wanting to pick a fight. And I was never really much of a fighter. And people like that, even if possibly I could beat them, they could intimidate me. You know, they had that kind of Fonzie attitude.
Right.
So anyway, he's kind of pushing me, and my friend actually got in his truck and he backed down the street. And so I kind of ran around the guys, jumped in the back of the truck, and then they actually got in their car and they were actually chasing us. And we ended up running a red light and we got away, which is, so, you know, of course you feel like so bad, like such a wimp, and like you always see the Bruce Lee movies and think, God, man, I wish I knew karate. I'd love to be able to just kick that guy's butt. But I had thought about that even before that, but I was never very flexible or particularly athletic and not very quick. And also I felt that if you were going to do something like karate, you would need to do it full contact for it to be realistic. And I really didn't want to get kicked and punched in the face.
Sure.
So anyway, shortly after that, both my friend and I were going to El Camino Junior College, and we were taking a self-defense course there. This Japanese guy named Mitsu Yamashita, who had done martial arts his whole life, he was like a fourth degree karate, second degree Aikido, and he taught a self-defense course there part-time at the college. And I don't know how, but somehow he had met Horian Gracie and started learning jiu-jitsu. And for him, that was like a revelation, because everything he knew was basically based on punching. And there's always that insecurity of, you know, somebody grabs a hold of you, a wrestler, you're in an elevator, you don't have the space to use your kicks and punches. So he would invite Horian in to do demonstrations. And I was lucky, just right place, right time to be there. And that was my introduction to jiu-jitsu.
Nice. And then, so the stars kind of aligned for you and you were just happened to be there.
Yes, yes. Nice. And actually he had done two demonstrations. After the second one, I hadn't started. At that time he was teaching mainly only private classes out of his garage in Hermosa Beach. There was a one group class on Sunday. And I said to my mom, I said, I got to do this. And my grandfather had some money that was sort of put aside an account for me for later in life. And I talked my mom into letting me use some of that money so I could start learning.
Mm.
And that's how I got started.
That's great. How old were you then?
I was 21.
Ah, nice, nice. You know, it's funny, the story you shared opening up about at the party and the potential fight happening and how that made you feel. Yeah, it reminds me of way back in the day when I was little, the little comic books. On the back of these comics, it was Charles Atlas, an ad for his strength course. And the infamous
90-pound weakling,
getting sand kicked in
your face. Yeah.
But you know, we've all have, or at least most of us have, had some kind of situation, you know, that left that effect and made us feel whatever, scrawny, less than, you know, timid, scared. And it really was a catalyst for a lot of us to seek out something and have that desire.
And I remember telling Horion at the time, I said, would this work for someone with average coordination and this and that? And then, you know, I did really well once I started, and he used to, you know, joke with me about that. But,
Nice. So you started training with Horion?
Yeah.
And
it was, so in those days, like I said, it was basically all privates, half-hour privates, and people will die when they hear the price. It was kind of expensive back then, but it's still super cheap, even probably relatively speaking compared to today. But it was $20 a half hour.
Nice.
Yeah. And wow. He had this picture book, and you would start with a couple standing techniques, like maybe a hip throw or a headlock, you know, standing headlock escape, and then do a couple ground techniques, like we call it now the trap and roll, but people know it maybe as the oopa, you know, that kind of mm-hmm. thing. And then the next class, you'd review the techniques, the four techniques you learned, and you learn four more. The next class, you'd review the eight and learn four more. And he would talk about, you know, this way it becomes a reflex. And he'd always refer to this picture book with all these, that had just the self-defense techniques in it, all the standing techniques.
Right.
And he would tell you, you know, not to practice with anybody. Nobody really did, for the most part, in those days, outside of, you know, the garage.
Mm-hmm.
But he would say, we don't want you to develop any bad habits, and we want to make sure you do it 100% with me, because if you get in a fight, you might only do it 70% correct, but it's still going to work. But if you practice it and you're practicing at 70% and you do it 50% in a fight, you know, it might not work.
Right. So you stayed doing the lessons with him for how long, and what was the next step in your journey?
Well, I'd say for about the first 3 months, I did a half hour private once a week. And then Hoist came here from Brazil. I think he had just turned 18. And so I started doing lessons with Hoist at that point. And I did that for about a year, and I got my blue belt. In those days, since it was all privates, it was basically like 36 privates and you get the blue belt. And at one point, I started doing two privates a week, and then I switched to one private a week and the one group class on Sunday, which had maybe six guys, you know, and you could only train two at a time. The other guys had to sit out.
Mm.
So anyway, Hoist moved here, and then after about a year, Hoist had to go back to renew his visa. And so I had been hearing about Brazil and never really wanted to go anywhere too much. I was always pretty happy in California, but, you know, I learned about Brazil and that struck my fancy. And so I ended up going back to Brazil with Hoist and staying with the family, with Hoist, Hoyler, Holker, Hobbin, and then two girls, Herica and Hisi, and Vera, who was the mother. She's the mother of Hoyler, Holker, Hoist, Herica, Hobbin, Hisi, the six other kids, and then, of course, Horion Helson Hickson are from another mother, but the same father, you know, grandmother,
right.
Grandmaster Elio Gracie. And so he didn't live there, but he would come there a lot and have meals and stuff. So I lived in the house with them. I shared a room
wow.
with Holker Gracie. And so I spent 6 months there just
nice.
Pretty much living the local lifestyle, going to the academy, you know, 5 days a week. There was group classes Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And in those days, well, going back in the garage, you know, it was either privates or the one group class on Sunday. And when there was sparring, it was usually positional sparring, like, let's say, okay, Marty, pass Chris's guard. And if you pass my guard, I'm out. The next guy comes in and you stay. So
okay.
you couldn't relax that much because you wanted to stay on the mat and train. So I would do everything I could not to let you pass my guard so I could stay.
Sure.
Because, you know, we had to rotate in and out because the garage was so small. You really couldn't have more than two people at a time training. So when I went to Brazil, it was big classes, like 30 guys.
Oh, wow.
And we would do a warm-up, and then we would do some, you know, drills of positions, different techniques, and then maybe an hour of just sparring. And, you know, some guys would be sitting on the wall tired, or you'd rest, or you'd go say, hey, you want to train? And just nobody kept time, just train as long as you want. And so that was kind of new to me.
That sounds great, man.
To get all those different bodies and all that extended sparring time. And so along with the group classes, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, like two-hour classes, I did on Tuesday and Thursday, I did a private with Hickson for 6 months because he was still living in Brazil at the time. So that's when I probably made my biggest jump in jiu-jitsu, my biggest improvement. I competed once there, and you had to compete inside the academy just to qualify to compete because there were so many competitors. So, you know,
wow.
myself and one other guy in our weight class, about 150 pounds, you know, made it. And then I competed in actually the Lightning Bolt tournament, which I believe is Hickson's last tournament that he competed in. And that was 1986. And I did pretty well. I believe I won two matches, and then I lost on points to a guy who won the division. And he also fought, I believe, Johnny Machado, and he also beat him at that time.
Wow, what an incredible opportunity and experience for you to get to go down to – you got Brazil fever, so to speak, way before most people had even, you know, thought about training down there. And you went down there and got to spend time and live with so many Gracies. And then to be able to be in this atmosphere and to be taking so many – privates with Master Hickson, man, what an incredible opportunity for you.
Yeah, it was really a great experience. And when I when I left Brazil, Grandmaster Hélio Gracie wrote a note in Portuguese that I gave to Horion, and it said to give Chris a purple belt. So
wow.
basically I came back after the 86 trip of 6 months, and then he gave me a purple belt. And, I mean, not to say that I'm that great, cause I'm nobody special. I was just right place, right time, started before everybody else. And, you know, the thing hadn't developed like it was now, but at that time I was pretty much like the best guy. As far as I know, there was like, you know,
wow, that's great, man.
Yeah.
And what did that feel like to be in that position like that?
Well, yeah, it was amazing. I mean, from the beginning, I loved it. I mean, I idolized Horion, and, you know, it was like, I mean, like going back to the garage days, you'd do like a half hour private. And I remember he'd invite you up to have dinner sometimes, and you'd have like corn soup and carrot juice. And he'd get out the old newspaper clippings of his father challenging Joe Louis and show you these old VHS tapes of, I think they called it NHB, No Holds Barred, or no, they called it Vale Tudo. And this was like the predecessor to MMA, you know, guys
right.
wearing Speedos and a boxing ring and no time limit, no weight class, you know, no,
wow.
everything goes, groin shots, whatever. And, you know, showing Hickson fighting Zulu.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh, my God, that's like a cockfight. You know, it was really intense. And
right.
So it was like you had a secret weapon, you know, because even wrestlers who are so formidable nowadays, they weren't that big a deal because you would triangle them, you'd armbar them, you'd slide around to their back. And, you know, so I, in some respects, I miss those days where it's like you could not get in a fight with anybody that knew jiu-jitsu because you knew everybody who trained.
Right.
You know, you knew the 10 other guys or 20 other guys.
Well, Richard Bressler speaks a little bit about that, too, that whole how it felt like a secret weapon, you know.
Yeah.
Because the people you're training with knew it, but other people that you would encounter.
Exactly.
Know, they didn't know. It wasn't widespread by any means.
Yeah.
So what a cool time to be involved in it. You're in a group called or known as the Dirty Dozen, which refers to the first 12 Americans that were got a black belt from a Gracie family member. So what's it like to be part of that group? And talking about Maxer Hickson, what's one of the most important things you learned from him that sticks with you?
Yeah, well, as far as the Dirty Dozen, that's an interesting story. About 3 years ago, I was training at the Torrance Gracie Academy, and one of the brown belts, I think it was Ryan Parker, he was talking, I heard him mention something about the Dirty Dozen, and I'm like, what's that? The top most pesticide-filled fruits and vegetables, you know?
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
Right? Yeah, and I didn't even know what it was. And he's like, no, it's the top 12 black belts, and you're one of them. Oh, really? Cool. I didn't even know. So
Wow. As
far as that goes, I knew I was the first American to get a black belt from Hickson, but I didn't know I was Dirty Dozen. Yeah, as far as Hickson, what was the question? What's the most important thing?
Yeah. What was the most important, or one of the most important things that stands out to your mind that you learned from your time with him?
Yeah. I mean, so many things and so many different phases. I guess I could start with when I was in Brazil, you know, doing all the privates with him, and he was passing my guard, and he would sort of, you know, adjust his level to your level, and I was kind of, I think they called it repose, or at Torrent or the Gracie University, we call it like block and shoot. Basically, if someone's kind of double underhook, passing your guard, stacking you, and you kind of block their hip and shoulder and hip out and recover guard or go to high
right.
low guard, that kind of thing. So I was doing that, kind of getting balled up and kept kind of recovering. And I thought, yeah, I'm doing pretty good. And then he said, you don't move your hips. You don't move your hips at all. So we did four privates with my hands in my belt, just using my legs.
And, oh, man.
Yeah. And he talked about, you know, your legs should be for defense, and then your arms are free to attack.
Mm.
And my game, especially my guard, just exploded after that. I mean, I remember none of the other blue belts could pass my guard immediately after those four classes. So that's one of the things I'll always do with students at some point or another is have them put their hands in their belt. And of course you got to do it with somebody ideally initially below your level and then maybe at your level and then, you know, work up because someone better than you is going to pass your guard pretty quick.
Right.
So that, I guess that was one thing. You know, he's an innovator. He always never accepts a technique, or he does for a while, but then he'll constantly improve things and modify things. You know, probably you hear about all the principles, you know, as opposed to just teaching you this technique, that technique, another technique,
yes.
or uber detail, you know, hold the fingers like this, the wrist like that, the elbow here. It's more like the way you keep your weight, the balance, the posture, the connection, making the opponent feel uncomfortable. I was thinking about this also when I don't even remember this so much when I was in Brazil, but when Hickson moved here, maybe around 89, and he was teaching at the Torrance Academy, and we would do groups, and it started becoming more like Brazil, and we would do these warm-ups, and he would incorporate all these jiu-jitsu movements into the warm-up. And I really don't remember anybody doing that before. I mean, probably they did, but I don't remember it. And so that kind of was like, wow, that's amazing. Like, think of like Karate Kid, where he's, you know, brush stroke, wax on, wax off. So he's learning these movements. So we do these movements like hip movements, different rolls, different, you know, standing hip movements. and things that would apply. So you're training your reflexes as mm-hmm. you warm up. You're also warming up all the joints and muscles that you're going to use. So that kind of stood out to me. Everybody does that nowadays, but I didn't think people really did that back then. And what else? I guess when I started teaching for him and I was nervous, I was a brown belt and I was worried that I might, you know, make some mistakes, teach some things a little bit wrong. And he said, you know, you're going to make mistakes, but the most important thing is that the student feels that you really want to improve them, you know, like they're your prize fighter and you have a lot at stake. And I always took that to heart. And I don't think that's something you can really fake, but, you know, I'd say that was one of the most important things.
That's big.
Yeah.
I mean, people can really feel when you have their best interest at heart, for sure. So I know a few years ago, I think it was 2013, you decided to go back to the Gracie Academy and go through their instructor certification program. Before we talk about that, kind of what fill us in a little bit on the years from where we were to that point in your journey.
Okay.
And then we'll talk about that part.
Yeah. So, 86, I came back from Brazil. You know, I actually started in November of 1984. And it's a funny thing. I didn't even know when I started exactly. And, you know, I don't know if you've been to the Gracie Academy in Torrance, but they have this really great museum.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Under glass, they have these old log books of the old private days in the garage. And actually, my best friend was in there, and he said, hey, I saw your name in the logbook. And I generally knew it was late 84, early 85. So I saw my name, Chris Saunders, November 1984. So I said, okay, I guess that's when I started. So going forward, so I came back from Brazil in mid-86. And, you know, Horian had moved from the Hermosa Beach garage to a garage house in Torrance and then a second house in Torrance. So I trained at three different garages. And then he opened the first Torrance Academy. I'm sure maybe around 1990, I'm guessing. I'm not sure exactly. So I started training there. Hickson had moved here. So I still maybe once a week was doing privates with Hickson and whatever group classes he was teaching. Then I actually got laid off from my construction job, maybe 91, and I didn't have money, and I was probably spending maybe $170 a month on training, and I stopped training for about a year. Hickson had actually separated from Horion and gone up to West LA, and I was so spoiled I didn't want to drive somewhere that was more than 15 minutes from my house, you know, even though it was maybe 45 minutes, an hour, you know, which
sure.
So I still trained at Torrance for a while. Then I got laid off. So I just stopped training for about a year. Then, you know, Hickson had been teaching at this Pico and Sepulveda school in West LA. And one day he just called me out of the blue and he said, hey, how you been? Have you been training? You know, I saw your name in the phone book, just thought about you. And I said, well, no, I haven't had any money. And he said, well, you know what? I'd rather see you train. And once you come up and train with me, and you don't have to pay me right now if you don't have money. And I was like, wow, that really kind of blew me away. And I'm not sure what would have happened, you know, if I ever would have trained again, if that didn't happen. And so then I went up there. And I hadn't trained in a year. And like I told you, I was like the best student, right? I would either get everybody or just control them positionally. Like some of the really big, strong guys, I maybe didn't tap them, but I would just, you know, pass their guard. They couldn't pass my guard, that kind of thing. And so there was a guy, maybe you've heard of him, Mark Eckerd.
I've heard the name.
Yeah, he got his brown belt through Hickson, and then he kind of left. He would have got his black belt. He got his brown belt like 3 months after me, and he probably would have got his black belt 3 months after me if he stayed. Anyway, he had been training at the Torrance Academy during the day, and he was like the top dog during the day. I was a top dog at the night. We never met. And so he started training with Hickson. So I went there after a year layoff, And he was already tapping out Luis Heredia, who was a brown belt. Mark was a little bigger, stronger guy. So Mark was a purple and Luis was a brown, but Mark was catching Luis. And Luis was, you know, teaching a little bit for Hickson there. And so I sparred with him after not training for a year, and we kind of stalemated, you know. He didn't get me, I didn't get him. Then we trained again with no gi, and he caught me twice. Then Hickson says, I'm going to give you a brown belt. And I was like, what? Because I was used to being, you know, the top guy, and I haven't trained for a year, and now somebody submits me, and I'm thinking, now you want to give me a brown belt? And I was like, I don't want it. And he got angry. So I was like, okay.
Yeah, I better take it.
You don't want Hickson angry.
No, you don't.
So then I trained really hard to feel like I, you know, I could deserve it, the brown belt. And right. So kept training with Hickson. Did a few competitions, you know, did well. Won maybe three different competitions. And then I would say December of 97, he gave me the black belt.
Wow. Nice. What an incredible experience, you know, for you to have.
Yeah, I was never really belt driven, you know, and I remember I had started teaching for him up in Oxnard, you know, part-time, and guys would always say, when are you getting your black belt? Or some people that I had competed against that I had beat who had gotten their black belts, they would ask me. And so I was more just glad to get it so people would stop asking me, but it really didn't matter that much to me as far as the belt. I mean, I knew I'd get a black belt one day, and it was
right.
important in that regard, but I was never like, I can't wait to get this belt or that belt. I just enjoyed the training and just, you know, enjoyed the journey.
So you just feel like it's just kind of a natural, it would be someday a natural part of the journey you were on.
Yeah, exactly. And
that's great.
So then I kept training and teaching. I was teaching one day for Hickson and one day up in Oxnard. I mean, at Hickson School. And the school up in Oxnard was like kind of an association, so it was through Hickson. And then I hurt my shoulder. I tore my rotator cuff. And actually, Hoxson had died, and, you know, Hickson was not at the school that often. And then I tore my rotator cuff, and Hickson might even, maybe he was still here, but so I stopped training for a while, and then Hickson had gone back to Brazil, and I was still doing belt testing at the West LA school, you know, doing Hickson's belt test, but I wasn't training there because of my rotator cuff. And I didn't get surgery, which I probably should have. Like, I saw an orthopedic surgeon, and he said it was completely torn. But I had some construction jobs, and I couldn't afford to take 6 months off work, so I really never did the surgery. And some of the other guys there, I don't want to mention names, but they weren't happy that I was doing the belt test, and I wasn't training there.
Right.
And so I started to feel a little alienated, and Hickson wasn't there anyway. So basically for like a 5-year period, I really didn't go to any school. I had one blue belt student who would come to my house a couple times a month. And that was really the only training I did for about a 5-year period. And I might've done one or two seminars, but then I went to the Torrance Academy to buy Combatives DVDs for my nephews who live in Maryland. I would always go there for Thanksgiving with my mom to see my sister. And then I went there a year later to buy them gis. And I really hadn't seen Hiron since he was maybe 10 years old, you know, because when I started, he was like 3 and Henner was like
yeah.
1. I wish I would have trained with them when they were like 10 or 12, so I could have submitted them as much as possible.
Right. Yeah, should have got it in while you
could. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I joke with him and I say that, do you remember when you were little and you wouldn't take a nap and your dad would ask me to put you to sleep so you could take a nap?
That's funny.
But anyway, so I went into the big group classroom, and Hedron walked up, and I was like, wow, he's 6'4", you know, he's,
right.
that was what really stood out, how tall he was. And, you know, I didn't feel like I really had a comfortable place to train. And he kind of took me under his wing. We did a couple privates, and then, you know, he really got me back into it. And then I started training, you know, so it almost came like full circle, you know, which is really cool because I started with his
Very
father,
cool. Right?
And he was three, and now he's an adult and just incredible, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I remember him mounting on me, and he's so concerned about people's feelings, like not making someone feel bad, and that's one of the amazing things about him and Henner and all those guys. But I figured when I trained with him, okay, I'll go like 5 minutes, I'll get tired, and he'll catch me. So he didn't even try to get me. He just mounted me. And I thought, well, usually if somebody is only trying to hold you, there's no threat of a submission, so it's kind of easy to get out because you don't have to worry about defending your neck or your arm. Or if they're only going for a submission, they leave a hole and you can get out, right? But he just held me, and I could not get out. And I was like, oh my God, you know, his mount pressure, his control, it was just insane, you know?
Yeah. He is a phenomenal human being. And I remember the first time I met him at a seminar in Norfolk, Virginia, and the same thing stood out. I had seen him on video, but had no idea he was so tall. And I was like, wow, dude is tall. And, but yeah, just every time I've ever been able to be around him, and even having him on the show here, he just exudes such a great presence and energy. You know, he's so concerned about people and not about ego, which is apparent in rolling. So it's an awesome thing.
Yeah, I mean, he's an amazing instructor, an amazing jiu-jitsu practitioner, but I think he's a better person.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
absolutely.
That, yeah.
So you reconnected with the academy and with Hedron.
Yes.
What led you to going through their instructor program?
Well, you know, I guess in those years where I wasn't really training anywhere, you know, you kind of you have an identity, and, you know, you kind of lose that identity. And actually, I don't really think it's good to strongly identify with anything, whether it's identifying with being smart or talented or having a beautiful wife or a beautiful house, because anything you can lose, and then what do you have, you know? So ideally,
sure.
You know, kind of a, you know, Zen Buddhist thing. You've got the happiness or the inner peace has got to come from within. But nevertheless, I'm human. I'm not perfect. So, you know, I had kind of lost that identity, and I was kind of felt like maybe I didn't have a purpose, just kind of floating. Mm-hmm. And it was great just to get back there and start training. And I actually went through the combatives program, which was pretty cool because I never tested for any belt. You know, in those days, you know, Hickson, Horian, Hoist, they're always around, and they would just see you, okay, here's a belt. You won a competition,
right.
You're doing well against the other guys, here's a belt, right? And so
right.
It's like I felt, in a sense, when I first started jiu-jitsu back in those early days, it was like, wow, what could happen in a fight? I mean, you're going to clinch, take the guy down. He's either going to turn his back, you choke him. He might push you, you spin for an arm bar, or he's on top of you and you triangle him, armbar him, or sweep him, you know, Kimura. It's like, what else could happen, right? Simple. And then you learn hundreds and hundreds of techniques and MMA and this and sports stuff, and it starts to get kind of complicated. And it was almost like you don't feel as confident as when you're a blue belt, in a certain sense. And so going through combatives was like, wow, this is really cool, because this is like the 36 techniques that are used with more success and more frequently than all the other 600-plus in all the fights that the Gracie family has documented over the last 85 years. It's all about defending yourself against a guy in the street. And, you know, what I feel the essence of a martial art is a self-defense. So it was kind of cool to kind of reconnect in that way. And, you know, nothing was 100% new to me, but there was a little different twist the way they did certain things from the way I would do them with Hixson. So in some ways it was a little tough because it was like teaching an old dog new tricks. I was so, I was so ingrained.
Had to empty your cup.
So anyway, I spent about 8 months, maybe 4 days a week doing combatives. And I remember the white belts would look at me and say, "Why are you here?" You know, because I'm a black belt. And, you know, of course I would help them a lot because once I saw it once, I could pretty much do the technique.
Got it. Sure.
And I also would, I got the DVDs and I'd review them and train a little bit at home. So then I actually tested, and that was the first time I ever tested. And it was funny because I used to do a lot of testing for Hixson, and, you know, 95% of people always passed, you know. And the guys would be so nervous, and I'd be like, "Hey, man, it's no big deal," you know, because I knew virtually everybody passed. And all of a sudden, I'm going to test for blue belt with Hiron, and I guess because I put a higher standard on myself, and
yeah,
I was actually pretty nervous to test for blue belt, you know, after 27 years
That's
of training.
Interesting. Yeah.
And so I did well. I got a 99.
Awesome. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. And, you know, so then I had mentioned to Hiron, because they, you know, they had so many young guys who had sharp minds, had come up in their system doing things exactly how they do it. That's all they've ever known, where I had all my Hixson style training, which, you know, it's a little different. And so I knew I could teach for them, but I wanted to feel like they wanted me, you know, like not just because I could.
Right.
And so I had I met Hiron for lunch one day, and I talked to him. And, you know, at that time, we had opened up the Beverly Hills School, and I was going there 1 or 2 days a week. And basically, like helping out the head instructor. Usually there's two instructors at the classes, so I was like the other guy. And the students thought I was just like a normal instructor, but I wasn't getting paid at that time. And, you know, I was so used to having like freedom and not being locked down to any schedule. And I said to Hiron about teaching, and I wanted to teach maybe one day a week. And he said, "Well, you know, if you're going to teach, you really got to do it like 3 days a week so that, you know, if you do an intro with the student and then you're not there, you want to bond with the students and all that kind of thing." So anyway, what ended up happening is maybe 3 years ago or so, 3.5 years ago, he needed to have two surgeries. He had a deviated septum, and he had to have his tonsils removed. And actually, after I had mentioned to him about teaching, he had given me access to this like 50 hours of videos, which has nothing to do with technique for the most part.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I've been through that program as well.
Okay.
Just to let you know.
Yeah. And I was watching it. I had it for like over a year, and I was like, "Yeah, I want to teach." And then every 6 months they'd have the ICP, and then 6 months would go by, the next one come up, the next one come up. And I was kind of slack on that because I was used to the old school days of just showing up and learning, and kind of felt like homework. You know, I wasn't really a fan of sitting in front of the computer, and, you know,
right.
So then Hiron had to have those surgeries, and he said, "Listen, I'm going to be gone for a few months or a couple months, and I want to know if you're interested in, you know, taking over some of the classes, but I really need you to go through the ICP, and it's coming up in 2 weeks." So I kind of crammed.
Wow,
and,
that's what you call cramming there.
Yeah, and I was, I was a little nervous because I felt like I'm a black belt, and all these guys who, you know, it's their life's mission to teach. They have a karate school in North Carolina or whatever, and they've spent all this money, and they've done all the videos, and they've learned exactly, you know, their system. And, you know, like I said, I'm the old dog trying to learn the new tricks, and I didn't want to embarrass myself, you know. But anyway, I went through it. And I did fine, and you know, I passed, and I was actually very proud of that, you know, got this certificate. And so then I started teaching, and I actually kind of was teaching every other Sunday. Me and another guy were rotating, and then I started teaching Mondays, and then Hidon said, hey, do you want to teach Wednesday as well? Sure, okay, I'll do that. And then he said, hey, instead of Monday and Wednesday and every other Sunday, do you want to teach Monday and Friday? I go, sure, I'll do that. And then he said, hey, do you want to just teach Monday, Wednesday, Friday? So it's like he kind of, I don't think it was intentional, but it was like he did the exact perfect thing to kind of ease me into it.
Yeah.
And like the more I did, the more I wanted to do, you know?
Right, right.
And so that's pretty much my schedule now. I teach Monday, Wednesday, Friday, every other Sunday. And then, you know, he does a lot of seminars, so you know, I'll fill in on Saturdays. Occasionally I'll go in on a Tuesday or Thursday to do private. So I probably average, you know, anywhere from 4 to 5 days a week of going there.
Awesome. That's great. That's great. I've never been to the Beverly Hills Academy. I've been to the Torrance, you know, a number of times, but I would love to get out there and visit that one as well.
Yeah, it's like it's like a little more upscale. It's like a spa almost, you know.
Nice.
Small main room. There's about 18 people max can fit in there. And then there's two private rooms, really nice bathroom and showers, and you know, just beautiful school, but it's more intimate, so the classes are much smaller.
Well, I got a couple of friends here that just went through the ICP just like a week and a half ago. They completed it, and right when they touched down, you know, in LA, they went up to Beverly Hills and visited, and were raving about it. And I asked if they met you, and they're like, "Yeah, I met him." So that's cool. I'm going to do an episode focusing on the ICP experience really soon. So I'm
going to
have those
guys. Yeah, so you went through it yourself.
I went back in 2011, so
yeah.
It was a phenomenal program.
Yeah, I really feel like, now I had taught for 13, 14 years prior to going through that, and I feel like I'm a much, much better teacher now after going through that.
Absolutely, absolutely. So when you're not on the mat, Chris, do you have any other hobbies that you enjoy?
Yeah. So other than, you know, I have a rental house, so, you know, anything needs to be done around there, you know, taking care of my tenants and just, you know, preparing food. I really don't eat out at restaurants like 99% of the time. I guess my biggest kind of hobby or interest is just all aspects of health and nutrition. So I spend a lot of time, you know, different newsletters and podcasts and books and just always studying about health and nutrition.
So I'm sure you could talk about that all day, but if you had to kind of condense it down a little bit, tell us your thoughts on, you know, your philosophy on nutrition and health and any recommendations you have for those listening.
Yeah, well, I've done just about every diet, you know, and so I've done, of course, when I was in Brazil, I was 100% on the Gracie diet, and they kind of got me into more, you know, fruits and blender drinks and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, that was when I was very young. And then maybe when I was 29, I had a girlfriend. We had read this book, Fit for Life, and I became vegetarian for a while and done like the Zone diet, you know, paleo, raw vegan, high carb, low carb.
Oh, you really have done the full gamut, haven't you?
Yeah. And I at different times, I thought, this is it. Like when I was on the raw vegan, this is it. Everybody should eat this way. When I was doing the paleo, this is it. Everybody should eat this way. You know, how can you argue with 2.5 million years of evolution, you know?
Right.
And now I'm a big believer in something called biochemical individuality, which basically means we're all different. You know, we're all snowflakes. And some people legitimately do very well and can stay on a sustained raw vegan diet. I wasn't one of them. It was great for about a month and a half, and then I started losing muscle, losing energy. It was not good for me. And so I think some people do great on a ketogenic diet where they have 85% fat and almost no carbs. And, you know, and some people obviously do fantastic on the Gracie diet. But I just believe that you got to figure out what's right for you. But I would say to start, just get rid of the crap, you know, like if something has ingredients, you probably shouldn't eat it, you know? Like
right.
Fish doesn't have ingredients, eggs don't have ingredients, milk, you know, lettuce, you know, fruit, it doesn't have ingredients. And then other than eating whole unprocessed foods, like foods you could get 100 or 200 years ago, just go for the highest quality possible. So instead of eating factory farm meat full of hormones and pesticides and fed GMO corn and soy, you know, get grass-fed meat, get wild fish, get organic fruits and vegetables or wild, anything wild would be okay. And then as far as the ratios of, you know, fat, protein, carbs, you know, that's where you got to kind of play around and see if a low-fat diet, a high-fat diet, a, you know, Mediterranean diet, whatever's best for you. So I guess
it sounds like you've come full circle and reached a very, what sounds like a mature place in that, because coming to the conclusion that everybody has to kind of find what actually works for them, you know, I think is really cool, because I, like you, have tried a lot of different things. And when you're in it, much like with martial arts, a lot of times, you know, you end up drinking the Kool-Aid and thinking everybody should do this, not only this, but exactly like I'm doing it. And, you know, one size doesn't fit all. So it's kind
exactly.
of cool that you've come to a place where, yeah.
It's so true. And even sometimes you switch your diet to paleo or vegan, and it might be awesome for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got to change that, you know, something called diet diversity, you know, switch it up, eat as many different, you know, colors of, you know, fruits and vegetables, and don't eat the same thing every day, you know, and rotate
Absolutely.
Things around. So I actually do follow a lot of principles of the Gracie diet. I guess some of the main principles is that meal spacing, you know, don't eat a meal, leave at least 4.5 hours between meals. And kind
right.
of because of my training and because I eat a relatively high amount of fat, I'm easily able to do that. So I always do that. And, you know, so I kind of, not necessarily 100% intentionally, but I'd say my diet is in some ways close to the Gracie diet, but I do not always combine the foods like they suggest. That's probably the one area where I don't really follow that.
Right, right. And like I said, I'm sure you could talk all day about that, but I do appreciate you condensing that down and giving us kind of a little taste of your insight. Can you share something about yourself, Chris, that people may be surprised to learn about you? And also, who's had the biggest impact on your life, personally and professionally?
Yeah, yeah. As far as surprise, people be surprised to learn about me, that's a little bit of a tough question because I'm really not sure about that. I mean, I guess maybe some of the things I do health-wise, you know, crazy things that I do that to the extremes I go to for my environment and everything I drink and breathe and make all my own toothpaste and deodorant and shampoo. And, you know,
oh,
I wear amber colored glasses starting at about 7:30 or 8 at night to block
yeah.
blue light, because
mm-hmm.
for millions of years, as we evolved, we were never exposed to these blue lights, which is sunlight, which is TV, computer, cell phone, overhead lights. These are like spectrums that are in the sunlight. And for millions of years, once the sun went down, the only light we were exposed to was moonlight and firelight, which is yellow spectrum. And what happens is it messes with your circadian rhythms and it shuts off melatonin production, which is critical for sleep and cancer prevention and hormones. So when I started putting these glasses on at night, you could still watch TV, you could still look at the computer, and you wouldn't be getting exposed to the blue light. And for the first time in like 25 years, I was able to get into a regular sleep-wake cycle.
Wow.
Sleep-wake
Phenomenal.
Cycle. Yeah. So, but people think it's bizarre, you know.
And people don't understand the reasoning behind things. They always think something's bizarre, so don't
yeah,
sweat.
Yeah, yeah. And
all right.
Yeah, you were asking about influence or?
Yeah, the biggest impact. It might be hard to narrow it down to one, but, you know, who stands out as having a huge impact on your life professionally and personally?
Yeah, well, I guess Well, there's a little overlap, but of course I'm going to say both my parents, you know, because I have a great relationship with them, and they've always been really supportive of me, helped me out a lot still to this day, and I'm real grateful they're both still alive. Anyway, so them, but as far as outside of that, you know, I started doing construction maybe when I was 20, just a little bit before I started training jiu-jitsu, and, you know, I worked for till I was about 29, and for this Australian guy, he was a contractor, and we did, you know, framing and, you know, just his work ethic and, you know, his lingo and just, you know, a lot. I learned a lot from him, and to be efficient, the way, you know, he would work real efficiently. I guess he had a big impact on my life because construction's basically been a big part of my life. And then as far as jiu-jitsu and life in general, I would start with Horion because, you know, like as far as how my life is today and what I've done, the girlfriends I've had, the trips I've taken, I mean, my life would be 180 degrees different. And of course, I idolized Horion back in the day. And I think everybody owes Horion, you know, a debt of gratitude. You know, everybody who's in MMA or any of the industries, you know, whether it's the Ultimate Fighter or magazines or clothing, you know, I mean, he basically caused a multi-billion dollar global paradigm shift, you know, by bringing Gracie / Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu here and creating the UFC. So, of course, Horion. And then, you know, Hoyce, I trained a lot with him and spent a lot of time with Hoyce. I was probably his first friend in the U.S. and went to Brazil with him. And at one point, when I was 21, you know, I used to go to parties. At that time I wanted to go to bars, but Hoyce was 18 and he couldn't go to bars, so I'd find some parties to go to with him. And he was like, "Hey, man, don't drink." So I, you know, for a while I completely stopped drinking because of his influence. And then, of course, jiu-jitsu-wise, I would say obviously the biggest impact would be Hickson as far as the techniques I've learned and how I train. And just, you know, of course, I idolized Hickson. And who else? Well, of course, right now I would say Hedon, you know, because he got me back involved in jiu-jitsu and just the kind of person he is. And, you know, I'd say I'm having the most fun teaching now that I've ever had. And it's I get the most enjoyment out of it because of how they treat everybody, how they're so uber concerned about every little aspect. I mean, I remember I was teaching a combatives class and it was standing headlock escape, you know, and you're kind of bent down with somebody in a headlock, you hold their hip, you step to the side, you step between their legs and kind of sit across and kind of roll them where you end up on top. I know, you know, the move.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I was saying to somebody, you know, sit your butt across, you know, like sit it across here. And Hedon came up to me like after and he said, "Hey, you said butt." It's like, yeah, say hips. You know, it's like they're so worried about offending somebody or, you know.
Right, right.
And I actually love that, you know, that they because when you do something, when you work for somebody or a company, it's awesome when they care so much about the product and they always want to improve it and make it as good as possible. And then, you know, I love Henner. He's amazing. And I admire his, in a good way, you know, his marketing skills, because I believe, you know, there's nothing wrong with marketing. You know, everybody needs to make a living. And if you have an amazing product and you want to share it, you have to market it. But he's very skillful with that. And, you know, they're all different, but they're all unique. And I appreciate their different personalities. Hoyler, you know, I spent the second time I went to Brazil in 1988, I spent 3 months there. And I did three privates a week with Hoyler for 3 months. So, you know, lived with him, rode to the academy with him, went surfing with him, you know. So Hoyler's you know, been influential.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask to sum it up. Is there anybody you'd like to thank or give a shout out to? But it sounds like you kind of did just then, talking about who's been, you know, instrumental and impactful in your life. So
yeah,
anybody that you haven't mentioned, you just want to acknowledge real quick.
Yeah, I'm trying to think who haven't I mentioned. I'll throw in Richard Bressler, just because I know he'll be happy to hear that. we're still good friends. And, you know, he was somebody who had an influence on my diet in the early days. He was always into all kinds of crazy stuff, like taking enzymes or probiotics or vegetarian diet or raw foods diet, even eating things like raw chicken. And, you know, so I always thought he was kind of bizarre, but then I would listen to him and I'd kind of maybe adopt some of his things. So, he definitely had some influence.
Very nice. Very nice. I've had I had him on the show a while back, and since then we've kept in touch over the phone, and find him just a really cool and interesting person. So really grateful I've had that chance to kind of cultivate that friendship a little bit. So
yeah,
very cool guy.
He's an awesome guy. Yeah.
Right on. All right. Well, listen, I appreciate very much your time, your insight, your sharing more about yourself and your story with us, Chris. You're very interesting and, awesome person. So thank you so much, brother.
Thank you, Marty. I appreciate it and I enjoyed it.
Okay, time for the Make a Difference, Make an Impact segment. Today I'll be playing a short clip from a video from Rabbi Dr. Abraham Twersky, and it's on responding to stress.
There's something I want to tell you about the stress and how we often look at stress, okay? And I think it's an important thing because many people have told me from my lectures the one thing they remember, okay? I was sitting in a dentist's office and looked at an article that said, how do lobsters grow? Well, I don't care how lobsters grow, but I was interested in it. And it points out that a lobster is a soft, mushy animal that lives inside of a rigid shell. That rigid shell does not expand. Well, how can the lobster grow? Well, as the lobster grows, that shell becomes very confining. And the lobster feels itself under pressure and uncomfortable. It goes under a rock formation to protect itself from predatory fish, casts off the shell, and produces a new one. Well, eventually, that shell becomes very uncomfortable as it grows, right? Back under the rocks. And the lobster repeats this numerous times. The stimulus for the lobster to be able to grow is that it feels uncomfortable. Right? Now, if lobsters had doctors, they would never grow. Because as soon as the lobster feels uncomfortable, goes to the doctor, gets a Valium, gets a Percocet, feels fine, never gets off its shell. So I think that we have to realize is that we have to realize that times of stress are also times that are signals for growth. And if we use adversity properly, we can grow through adversity.
Okay, great words, and keep in mind, I've always said that you have to get out of your comfort zone to grow, and it's always good to remember that. And be reminded of that. And that's going to do it for this edition of the show. As always, thanks for listening. I really hope you're enjoying the show. Don't forget to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and take a moment to rate the show on iTunes if you're an iTunes user, and leave a comment there. Or you can leave a comment on the website at www.graciejiujitsurocks.com. I'd love to hear from you, so don't hesitate to reach out to me via email, as well as remember to send in your questions for Peter on Gracie. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, this is Marty Josie, and I'll see you on the mat.